This is Wells Tech, episode 327 for Tuesday, February 4th, 2014. Sally, Jason, and I have a little Wi-Fi chalk talk as we discuss the ins and outs of setting up a Wi-Fi network in your church or school. Drew Willems from Shoreland Lutheran High School also joins us to talk about their technology plans and their Wi-Fi network. Lots of good stuff from him and lots of good stuff going on out there at Shoreland. Picks, tips, whole lot more. Stay tuned.
This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net.
It is time for Wells Tech, a show about technology and ministry and our journey to find where those two meet. And joining me along the way, as usual, Sally Draper. Hi, Sally.
Good afternoon, Martin Spriggs. How are you today?
I'm fine. I kind of screwed up our intro already. We've changed this like three different ways from Sunday, so I have no idea how to start this show anymore.
The professionals at work here, be warned, everyone.
We just try and keep it loose here. You know, we don't want the structure. We don't need that kind of stuff. We just are out there. You know, that's our approach. Just be out there. So, and we're happy that other people are out there with us. And if you are watching live, you should have an opportunity, if you so choose, to join that conversation with the Q&A tool with Google Plus. And those of you that are watching or listening to this via an archived copy, every Tuesday, 4 o'clock Central, you are invited to join us if that fits into your schedule. We'd love to have a live audience, and we'd love to have you join us and be a part of that. So, not a requirement, but an option. We like to give options.
I think it's been a fun option. We've seen some interaction, and it's adding a new dimension to the podcast and a new thing for us to juggle among the seven different windows that we're looking at on our screen. So
that's about it. And we're gonna introduce even more technology here in a second, Sally. But we'll see how that goes.
Yep. Today, our focus is on wireless infrastructure, and in a little while, we're hoping that Jason Schmidt can actually join in on the podcast as well. Jason regularly joins us with the education technology perspective, and he's out there in the Omaha, Nebraska area fighting a snowstorm, I understand, today. So we're hoping that he is somewhere safe and able to join us soon.
And if not, then we'll muddle along and the good news is we were talking about a topic that had some interest from one of our interviewees, Andrew Willems, or Drew Willems, depending on maybe your stature and friendship with him. I don't know. I didn't ask him actually what his preference was, but Drew Willems is the technology director at Shoreland Lutheran, and he's a I guess we would call him a Wells Checker, right, Sally?
Definitely.
Somebody, friend of the show, attended our unconference out in New Ulm, and is very willing to share stuff and doing some cool things, not only with wireless infrastructure, which is really the topic of the day, but a whole bunch of other stuff at Shoreland. Kind of a neat time to be a student, I would think, at Shoreland, with somebody paying attention or at the controls like Drew is with their technology initiatives. So should we play that interview? I think maybe now is the time, and then we'll come back and cross our fingers that Jason has joined us. So just a little bit of intro here. I just installed a program. So we're trying to work around Google Plus. Google Plus doesn't have the ability to stream video. Now, you can play YouTube videos, but only you and I would see it, Sally. None of the on-air visitors would see it. So I've kind of rigged it up through a tool called ManyCam, through another meeting participant. So I'm actually in here twice.
And personality.
Hopefully I've got this all queued up that it will allow me to play the video and everybody will be able to see it and hear it. So We are very happy to have joining us on Wells Tech today, Drew Willems, the technology director at Shoreland Lutheran High School in the greater Racine area. Racine, for those of you outside of the Wisconsin motherland, is southeast corner, you know, of the state. Welcome, Drew. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm deeply honored.
Well, I don't know what an honor it is, but we're happy to have you. And we've met before, and we've talked on various occasions. You were at our UN conference up in New Ulm, so thank you for joining us for that. We enjoyed having you there, and we felt that you could offer some things to the table. The conversation today on today's show is really all about technology in education, and specifically we've been talking about Wi-Fi infrastructure. You have kind of the whole ball of wax there at Shoreland, so tell us a little bit about your position there and hobbies, family, that kind of thing. Introduce yourself.
All right. Well, Andrew Willems is my God-given name, and my wife Heidi and I will be married for 25 years this July.
Congratulations.
And we have 5 children. Sarah is 21 and a junior at MLC. My son Aaron is 19 and he works for a company in Racine installing security systems. We have a 17-year-old son Noah who's here at Shoreland, a 15-year-old son Luke at Shoreland, and our baby of the family is the 13-year-old daughter Hannah who goes to Wisconsin Lutheran School in Racine, as our family is members at Epiphany here in Racine.
Very nicely spaced across the spectrum there.
And you serve at Shoreland, but...
Yeah, I've only been at Shoreland for a year and a half. I spent 23 years at Trinity St. Luke's School in Watertown, the last 10 of which I was their director of technology. So when Shoreland called me, I had to do a little research. I had to get a little smarter in order to advance in the ways of teaching and technology in the high school situation, but it's very similar, very comparable.
Very good. Well, I'm really anxious to hear about kind of the state of technology at Shoreland, and I know you guys have plans in motion, so maybe you can give us a little bit of an overview of the infrastructure there and your different initiatives you have going on.
5 years ago, actually about 4 years ago, they implemented a 5-year plan of technology. They started with the wireless infrastructure, which they had never had before, and we put in some UniFi managed access points, and they're dual channel. So on each access point, we have students and faculty on a Shoreland network, and then we also have a guest wireless network available at all times during the day. So in the morning when the kids come to school, their iPods and their iPhones and their tablets are on. And then at 7:45 when school starts, any device they get on as a student goes on to the Shoreland network. So we've had at most about 350 devices on our wireless.
Wow.
And that would be the first place to start if you're thinking of going one-to-one, is make sure you have robust wireless access and then also internet access. We recently upgraded through our Time Warner cable 30 megabytes down and 10 megabytes up. But in the summer we'll be going fiber optic through the BadgerNet Teach Network internet provider, and then we'll have 100 megabytes down and 100 megabytes up.
Wow.
So 350 on at one time, that's a lot. How many students are there actually?
Actually, we have 307 students right now. So that's one thing technology directors have to plan for in the future, is not one-to-one, but x-to-one, you know, 3 devices at a time. In fact, I just came from my programming class where a student was on the computer and he had his iPad and he was on his iPhone. So he was actually using three devices to do one assignment. So that's the future.
So you spoke of one-to-one. We've been talking a lot on the show about that, and specifically a lot of our schools are going the Chromebook route. Sounds like you are headed that direction as well. What kind of preparation and things are on your radar to make that happen? And first of all, is it school-wide? Are you doing it by class or department?
Next year, we'll be going school-wide. We will become a bring-your-own Chromebook device school.
Oh, okay.
So right on their school supply list, the first item is a Chromebook. Any Chromebook they want, but we want a Chromebook so we can manage it, all the apps and things in the Google console, and also we're going to be using the Hapara document management system, and that will also help teachers kind of keep a handle on what's going on each student's screen. So this year we're doing a bunch of in-service, 50 hours per teacher on doing project-based learning, on doing collaboration. Last year we became a Google Apps school for documents and Google Sites, and now we're just trying to implement them into their lesson plans so that by summer they'll be comfortable with that. In fact, next month at our two-hour in-service, they have already written a lesson plan and they're going to practice teach it to the small groups to see how that goes, and then give each other tips and suggestions.
So, Drew, just a follow-up to that, most of our teachers or tech folks that are listening are probably not doing this on a high school level. They're probably doing this on an elementary school level. Any advice there? I mean, you came out of a grade school setting, one-to-one. Does this go down to a certain grade? Do you see some of this going end-to-end?
Well, a bunch of grade schools in our federation pretty much start at 5th through 8th grade. There are three grade schools now that are one-to-one Chromebooks in 5th through 8th grade in our federation. But there's a couple of them that go down to 3rd grade with maybe an iPad or some kind of Chromebook device. Or they have a cart of Chromebooks that just kind of float around in the lower grades.
Right.
You know, most children at home are comfortable with technology, and teachers in the elementary schools are starting to see their educational value. The students are comfortable with them already. Why not have them use them as an educational tool as well?
And you mentioned students specifically. You guys have some plans to encourage the student adoption and bring out some student leaders, I understand?
Yes, that is correct. We are going to start this summer what we're going to call an organizational or a club, organizational group or a club group called the Chrome Academy. And they will have to complete 4 days worth of training, and then they will be available to help teachers in the classroom or students if they have questions about Chromebooks or the Google Apps, and they will man the Chrome Depot, we're going to call it, during the school day so that everybody knows where they can go for help. There'll be a ticket system. There'll be different levels of support. Maybe one student excels at fixing a broken Chromebook, or another student it will be an expert at Google Sites. So you can come to the Chrome Depot, put in your request, get somebody qualified to help you. So eventually I'd like to have a couple teachers there as well. But it's worked in other public schools in larger districts in the Chicago area, so that's where I stole the idea from. And, in fact, I stole the names, too. I'm not that creative.
I want to go to Shoreland and be in the Chrome Academy. That sounds like
there you awesome. Go. We're going to get T-shirts printed, too.
So. Oh, man.
I like the Chrome Depot name, too.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Very good. Tell us a little bit about the flipping that's going on as well. I know we've talked in the past on the on the podcast about flipped classrooms, the concept of videotaping your lecture, basically, and having the students watch that outside of class so that your class time is more focused on the on getting the work done and answering questions. You have some of that happening at Shoreland as well?
Yes, currently we have one teacher. Kevin Zimmerman does our freshman required physical science course, and he has flipped his entire class for the whole year. He spent this summer mostly reading about good tips and tricks, and then he flipped almost his whole first semester before school started. Right now he's in the midst of using some already prepared lessons and then making some new ones. Actually, tomorrow, January 31st, our entire science department is going to a workshop on flipped classrooms. One thing Kevin has noticed is that kids are kids, and they get bored no matter how you present a lesson. So they may fall asleep during your lecture in a classroom. They're going to fall asleep at home if you lecture every day at them as well. So our chemistry and biology teachers want to flip either certain units or use it one day a week. But they're also going along with Kevin and going to see what other teachers are doing, hopefully avoid their pitfalls and learn some good tips and tricks for their classroom, and also then pass it along here to other teachers at Shoreland.
Now, Drew, you mentioned going back to classroom management and flipping. You mentioned a product that is probably specific to the Google platform for a learning management system. Do you have a school-wide learning management system that you use?
Yes. Currently, we use Moodle for our learning management system. And there are quite a few teachers that have all of their coursework on Moodle. So, for instance, Our U.S. geography teacher, Paul Strutz, all of his worksheets, all of his maps, all of his group activities, all of his project assignments, they're all listed there. Excuse me, they're all listed there on Moodle, and kids can go back to them at any time. So while he doesn't flip his lecture time at all, it's a good reference for notes or outside resources. So in essence, his classroom is kind of blended learning. It's a little online with some videos and assignments and worksheets, but yet they also meet face-to-face. So Dr. Jason Lowry, our academic dean, and I met yesterday to discuss how we can do that in the future, maybe even perhaps having U.S. geography as a class, but you don't have to meet in a classroom at a certain time every day. So you can be a little more flexible as a student with your schedule. Might enable people to overload or take more electives, or even just free up scheduling for our registrar's office.
Very progressive ideas. That's exciting to hear. How about the future, Drew? What do you see as the next big ed tech initiative you're going to be tackling, or maybe you see into the future that our other tech directors in schools should be preparing for?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah.
Next year at Shoreland, we're going to focus on collaboration and content creation. So having the kids more creating and using information. We're spending a lot of time this year helping them research relevant facts, current up-to-date facts, and now make something out of it, apply it to a question or a problem next year. But kind of like I said in my opening remarks, I think you have to get ready for X to 1. Having kids bring devices that maybe they're more comfortable with, but more importantly, they have specific roles to play. Maybe it's easier to research on your Chromebook, but maybe your iPad app will help you make a video better than a Chromebook will or YouTube. You know, just looking at that, how can you use texting and your phone in class, maybe with a little back channel like Socrative, where you can ask questions of the teacher without having to raise your hand and be all conscientious about, I'm asking a question in class, I don't know anything. So, you know, maybe those types of things are the future of education.
Excellent.
Great. Drew, you talked a little bit about these the in-services that you're doing, the 50 hours that they'll wind up with over the course of the year for, you know, things like project-based learning. Are you kind of rolling your own? Are these all resources and training materials that you're walking them through that you've built or people on staff have built? Or are there resources that maybe you can reference for other people who are thinking about doing this that they can, you know, grab onto and use?
Well, we pretty much tailor it to our own individual needs and our uses. So we did not subscribe to professional development sites. There are some out there where for $1,000 a year you can get something. But between Dr. Jason Lowry and myself and then our principal, Paul Scriver, we meet a couple times a month to figure out what our teachers need and where we want to go, what our end product we want to see from teacher lessons. And then we do the research, or we pop a YouTube video in our Moodle site that we'll run through. A big thing our teachers wanted was they wanted to be taught the way that they will teach the students with a Chromebook. So at professional development, everybody brings a Chromebook or a laptop. We run large group, we run small group, and then we work one-on-one as well as practice teach, as team teach, and give each other feedback. It's kind of a weird thing in the Wells. You know, I started teaching 25 years ago, and my principal came in once a year to make sure we were okay and alive. But now you have partners in the gospel where you can go to fellow teachers and ask for help, and they're willing to give you ideas and say, well, this didn't work so well for you, but this worked good for me. You know, maybe just try it again, and it'll go better next time.
That's great, Drew. Exciting stuff there at Trillin. Almost makes me want to go back into high school.
Yeah.
Well, it makes every day exciting, and you want to come to school to teach. And we're starting to see the students. You know, it's the end of January. They don't have the midwinter blues yet because they also are wondering, what's next coming up here at Shoreland? What kind of lessons am I going to get? What am I going to be interested in?
Yeah. Well, if you see a spike in enrollment after this podcast airs, you'll know why.
That's right.
Cool stuff you're talking about.
That would be good. So. Yeah, we're building a new science wing this summer, so we need about 20 more students next year.
Okay, we'll see what we can do about that. Drew, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you sharing, giving us a little peek into what's going on at Shoreland. And blessings on your ministry there. Sounds exciting, and you're off to a great start.
Well, thank you guys, too. And Sally, I know you didn't get much time in edgewise here, but thanks. And we appreciate what you guys, too. I know a lot of people watch the archive broadcasts. I was live on last week's broadcast, but only because we had a snow day, so I could make it. But otherwise, I watch the archive versions, too. So thanks very much for your work.
Appreciate your viewership.
Thank you.
As well. Thanks, Drew. Have a great day. All right. Thank you, Drew. Appreciate that. Kind of weird, Sally, watching us interview somebody while we're, you know, while we're doing the show, a little bit behind the scenes. Normally, when we do the show, we just plop in the interview in post. So we actually are reacting to an interview that we conducted, you know, maybe a week or two ago. And here we can react to the interview we just watched. You know, I found myself wanting to ask other questions because he was an awesome interview.
Yeah, lots of great things going on there at Shoreland. I'm really excited for the students that they're producing that are getting all of these wonderful skills that they'll take on with them into life. So great stuff.
And in the meantime, Jason's in from the snow. Hi, Jason.
Hey, guys. Thanks for accommodating me a little bit. I appreciate the letting me take a couple extra minutes to get home.
No problem. We're nothing if not accommodating. We roll with the punches, right, Sally?
That's right. Ready for anything. Oh, my goodness. I'm ready for a good discussion of wireless infrastructure. And I have a lot to share here, guys. I have great knowledge about wireless infrastructure that I want to let everybody know. Wireless should be super fast, super easy, totally secure, and always available. So that's my criteria, and I hope you guys have a solution that fits all of that.
We totally have that solution, Sally, but you forgot cheap.
Oh, yeah, I don't even care. I just want it. I want it all. That's your problem about money, you know. So.
Well, you bring up, actually, what you're talking about is really what students and teachers, that's all they care about. They don't really care about all the things behind the scenes necessary to make that happen. And Jason can attest to this too, that's not easy to accomplish. And that's really the point of our conversation today is, boy, wireless is an expectation today. It's a needed educational tool. And if it doesn't work, things come crashing down pretty quickly. And that's a problem. You know, we can't stand between the student and the teacher in that educational process. So there are you know, a lot of things to think about and a lot of things that probably need to go in, Jason, to the planning process, right?
When you're setting up a wireless environment, it takes a lot of planning and a lot of thinking ahead. You know, you can't it used to be you could just kind of, you know, go to Best Buy and pick up two or three Linksys routers, and you know, you're probably gonna be, you know, it's not ideal, but it'll be okay. It'll be adequate enough for kind of making things work the way that you need them to work. But that kind of thing doesn't cut it, particularly in a school environment. Now, there are a lot of things that you need to consider, and a lot of things that that have to go into that as you're planning for that, and making sure that that's gonna work and do all of those things that Sally mentioned at the
right
capacity and the speed and availability that you need.
Yeah, Drew mentioned a couple of things, and he mentioned one a couple times, and that's that X to one concept where capacity planning is really critical. I mean, you can get by with, you know, the Best Buy approach if you just got a couple people in the classroom, and maybe it's just the teacher or an aide needing to get access to present material or whatever. But the minute you start asking students to jump on the network at the same time, then you're going to have some problems if you haven't really thought through and invested in some quality equipment along the way. So it's you know, there's again a lot of strategy involved with this. And I guess my general encouragement, and Jason, I think you'd probably agree, is that if this is kind of a new thing to you, if this is maybe not a primary responsibility and you don't have a lot of networking experience, you should go find that. And if necessary, go pay for that, because this you really need to get right, or you're gonna have some downtime.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, there's a lot more involved than just going out and buying 10 access points and just put them in, and now it looks like we need one in every room. And you know, it used to be, honestly, that would be okay. You know, there are, I know of some school districts in Nebraska where they would buy their laptops for their teachers, and then every classroom got an AirPort, and that was adequate. That provided the access that they needed. But you know, now you gotta plan. You gotta have some knowledge about things like, you know, channels and frequency and bandwidth, and you know, if something like, you know, if a term like power over Ethernet is completely foreign to you, then find somebody who can help you out.
Right.
Because you need to take all of those things into consideration. Because if you don't, then it can be a disaster, and you end up wasting a lot of time and effort and money eventually.
You can't just have that. I think a lot of schools are having this one-to-one computing conversation, but they really need to front end that with, you know, the access question. So yeah, it'd be great, and hopefully we can afford and some kind of pricing model to get a computer in every kid's hands. But really, that's just the beginning. If they can't get to the resources that you're providing, which are mainly going to be on the internet, then that one-to-one computing initiative will ultimately fail. So a number of things that Drew mentioned and Jason, you touched on as well, that you want to think about. I think when you're putting in a wireless network, you need anywhere access or anywhere coverage. So you need to be able to walk from one end of the building to another without having to log into a different SSID. So, oh, I've got to get on the 8th grade classroom's network, or I got to get on the 7th grade classroom or 6th grade. Yeah, that needs to flow through. So most of the routers that we're going to be talking about will do that pretty seamlessly. So that's something that you want. Obviously, you need to support a number of devices, maybe not just one. So they may be bringing in, your students may be bringing in, or your faculty or other people in the building may be bringing in other devices. So it's not just, well, we need the capacity to support one access or one connection per student. And then obviously the quality, you know, needs to be taken into account. Also the ability to segment your network. So you want to be able to maybe push your guests without login credentials needed into one network, and then your students and maybe even your faculty on different networks, so that you can kind of parse out the bandwidth for that, or keep things separate, or even restrict access to different things by what network they're on.
Yeah, and you know, that security aspect is really an important consideration that people need to keep in mind. You know, if you in our congregation, for example, we have our member management software is on our network, and that part of our network needs to be separated from the access that other people have, just because, you know, it's just basic security. We want to make sure that that information is safe. You know, and depending on what information you have on your network, you need to keep those kinds of things in mind. And, you know, like you said, and like what Drew was saying too, you know, how they're increasing their bandwidth and making sure that they have adequate internet access. That's another thing. You know, you can, by segmenting your network like that, you can prioritize some of your traffic and make sure that your staff and your students have adequate bandwidth to do what they want to do. While, you know, if you have a teacher's conference or something like that coming in, you know, you can adjust the kinds of things that people have available, and with the residential kinds of products, you're not going to be able to have that kind of control. So you want to have something enterprise class for sure if you're even considering a one-to-one environment.
Yeah, I think Drew actually mentioned BadgerNet. If you're in Wisconsin, there's programs for schools to be part of upping that bandwidth at a more affordable price. And I'm guessing other states may have programs like that as well, so you'll want to look into that.
Yep. The good news is it doesn't have to be real expensive. There are products out there, and this is actually a very different story than it was maybe even 3 or 4 years ago when these products didn't exist, where trying to get that kind of Wi-Fi coverage over an area that, you know, makes ease of access just that easy, that was an expensive proposition. You had to go through companies like Cisco and, you know, some that are, you know, major players in the networking industry. Now you've got companies like Drew mentioned, UniFi, which is the Wi-Fi tool of choice, at least when schools ask me what I would recommend. It's what we use in the Senate office. It's what I took out to Hong Kong and put in Asia Lutheran Seminary. It's really an easy approach to getting Wi-Fi. Now, you have to understand networking a little bit. Again, it's not, you know, like a wizard interface where you just click and go. You have to have some kind of knowledge of where to put these access points and how to configure them. But I think the pricing is actually very attractive for schools or congregations wanting to get this rolled out. And, you know, for a pack, I think for a 3-pack of access points, even their long or extended range ones, they call them, very affordable, low 200s. You know, so it's maybe 70, 75 bucks an access point. And then the software comes with it. You need a server to run that on. But other than that, you're in pretty good shape, and I have found the administrative interface, fairly easy to use and fairly intuitive. So that is one option. So if you're thinking about maybe going this route and getting off of the, you know, the Linksys or, you know, that grade of access points that you maybe have in your school now or your church now, this would be definitely be something to look at. From Ubiquiti, it's the Unify brand of access points.
Jason, you have a different solution. Martin mentioned Cisco, and your school district, I believe, you're using a product from Cisco.
Well, this is not, my school district isn't using these.
Okay.
But this is something that people in, that people that I know are using and are very happy with.
Sure.
This is Cisco's Meraki. And that's what these are. What's nice about these is you don't have to have a server. You don't even have to have one of their boxes to manage them or anything like that. Everything is out in the cloud, and they're what we call self-aware. So if you have it's basically plug and play. You know, if you don't have a whole lot of knowledge of networks and how they work. You can basically plug and play these access points, and they take care of themselves. So, you know, if you've got two of them too close together and they kind of notice that there's some interference, then they'll change channels dynamically, and adjust themselves. So we call it a self-healing network. So that's a really nice thing about them. But obviously, it's a Cisco product. And it's a little bit more expensive than the Unify access points that Martin was talking about. And then the other thing that goes with these that's kind of a gotcha, and another thing that's attractive about the Unify ones, is that you with pretty much any other enterprise level product, you're gonna need to pay an annual or every three year or a five year license
maintenance fee, your license fee.
Or a maintenance fee, right? And then that ensures that your access points get firmware updates and those kinds of things. There are some security features as well that they make sure are available. It's all necessary and it's all good. But if the Unify access points, and that was something I hadn't seen before. Before we prepared for this show. I mean, I've heard of them, but I'd never seen them or really had any firsthand knowledge about them. Those seem like they would be a really good solution particularly for our schools, because we want to, you know, we're obviously working off of a smaller budget than some other systems might be.
Right. Great. There'll be some other resources on the show notes page. We'd love to hear your experiences. So if your school or church has gone down this path, put in a Wi-Fi network and are happy with the results and feel that this might be something worth sharing, why not write a review? We have a listener review segment in this show. This week we have nothing in that category. So if you have a review of maybe your wireless experience, please share that with us, and we'll publish it on the show. And in the course of doing that, you will have registered yourself to win a Nexus 7 tablet for listener review. We also have a ministry resources section as well. So if you have something that not even just doesn't have to be a hardware or review type thing, just something that you want to share that might be useful in ministry, please do that as well. All right, should we move along, folks? I think we are up to our tips of the week. And I'm gonna trot my tip out here first. And full disclosure, the tip that I have was not original to me. It was a tip that was shared with me by Rob Gunther, one of our Hall of Fame Wells Techers. He only shared it with me. He didn't share it with Sally.
Tricky.
For a very special reason. And that's because it has something to do with our paper versus paperless conversations we've had in the past. So
y'all are ganging up on me, it sounds like.
I need all the help I can get. You do fun by yourself, Sally. Hopefully you're seeing this on the screen. It is basically Kindle related. Again, those of you that maybe are new to the show, I'm a big proponent of trying to go paperless, and I don't buy paper books at this point if I can help it. I like to read them on a Kindle or via a Kindle Reader app on, you know, an iPad or whatever. And one of the things that one of the objections that's been raised about going paperless is, well, how do you take notes? You want to highlight and you want to add notes or write in the margins or whatever. And I talked about being able to do that via the Kindle app. It's actually pretty easy. But then how do you get the notes out? How do you look up those highlights, the highlighted pages or the notes that you made in the margins, etc.? And it turns out that Kindle has thought of that, or Amazon, who owns Kindle, has thought about, is there's a highlights page. And if you go to kindle.amazon.com/your_highlights, you'll have to log in. You will see all of the notes and highlights that you have made over the course of reading that book. So it saves it up to the cloud. You can cut and paste this, as Rob said, into Evernote. So you can search this. You can index it. You can, right here on the page, add or edit notes or delete a highlight. As I'm scrolling through, those of you that are watching, all the book reviews that we've had, I can look at all the highlights that I made, all of the notes that I made, and just a one little handy reference. I can even click on the link that says read more at whatever location it was, so I can dive right back into the book. It'll launch the cloud reader version, or the web-based version, so I can actually go right to the context of the book. So it's just my own little bookmarking tool here that really solves a problem. So my thanks, first of all, to Rob Gunther for letting me know this. I did not know that this was out there. I know you could look at it on the device itself, all the highlights, but this is even better because you can cut and paste and send it to Evernote and whatever. So that is a great find as far as I'm concerned. So
pretty useful stuff. Thanks.
Sally, you're up next. Do you have a
tip? My turn?
No other reaction than the pretty useful tip.
Okay.
Moving right along.
I can't give you too much credit, can I?
I was just thinking, huh, I wonder what would happen if I highlighted the whole book.
Ah.
You're a rebel, aren't you?
Make that hard because you can't even... That's one problem I've had with the Kindle, is that you can't highlight across pages.
Start
a highlight in one paragraph and the paragraph creeps to the next page. I've not at least found a way to extend that highlight even to the next page.
So these work well for that on paper, I'm just saying.
She held up her digital highlighter.
Yes, I did. Perfect. My analog highlighter. Oh. It's nice and pink.
There you go.
All right, Sally, what's your tip? You have a counterpoint, or is this totally off? You know,
no, it's totally Sally is without a tip this week, except I have a story to tell, and that is that we do all our planning for the Wells Tech podcast in cloud-based mind map solution run by MindMeister. And about 15 minutes before the show was to start today, MindMeister was down, and I had no backup of all the work that I'd put into this mind map and what we were going to discuss today. So I was just a little bit panicked. You know, I get used to the fact that MindMeister and all the Google Drive apps save automatically. I'm kind of out of the habit of even hitting a save button if I work in like Microsoft Office products or whatever. I have to really think hard to save things. But I guess the moral of the story today is, don't just save it to the cloud. If it's really important, make sure you download a copy as well. So I just lost just a tad bit of trust in the cloud today, and I want to pass that along and give you just a word of caution. So that's my tip. Really exciting, positive tip, huh?
So did you add that just like 5 minutes before the show?
Yeah, I didn't have a tip, so worked out well that they crashed on us.
God's hand, yes.
Yes.
Right. Jason, you have a tip. What's your tip?
Well, and my tip kind of goes hand in hand with Sally's a little bit. What I want to show you guys is the Chrome App Launcher. What this is this is Chrome continues to get better and better, which is totally awesome. But you can use the Chrome App Launcher to enable offline apps with Google Chrome. So, you know, we talk about Chromebooks and how you really just need to have really good web access for those to work well. That's becoming less and less the case. You don't need to have really good internet access if you enable offline apps and you enable offline access to your apps. So all that it takes is you just you go to chrome.google.com/webstore/launcher, and you know I think I have the link to that, and if not, I'll send it to Sally and make sure that gets into the show notes. But what this does is it puts a little app on your desktop, and basically gives you an icon on your computer that works just like the launcher on a Chromebook. So and if you have offline apps, it puts those in there. You can play Angry Birds on the airplane, and you don't have to worry about having your internet access because it downloads everything to your computer, and you can just run it from there. So, and that way you can access your stuff even if you're offline. So, my tip is to use if you're a Chrome user, use the Chrome App Launcher.
I'm gonna have to give that a try with MindMeister Maps. That would solve my problem now, wouldn't it?
So does that, I assume it works in conjunction with the Chrome browser, so you have to be a Chrome user.
Correct, yes. And the apps that you install in Chrome and the extensions that you install in Chrome, not the extensions, just the apps, that's what your shortcuts are. So,
gotcha.
So it's almost like kind of creating, how you always used to, I used to have shortcuts to websites on my desktop. I don't do that anymore. I just add the app, and then I've got it right there in the launcher. But there are some apps that are offline, and if they're offline and you have that enabled, then you can use it no matter what.
Yep. Cool. Thanks. Jason, we're going to let you keep going with your pick of the week.
Oh, yeah. My pick of the week. I am super excited about my pick of the week. this is, if I bring up my screen share, maybe. I didn't have an offline app for the screen share, so I'm not 100% sure if I can get that one to work. And I've been kind of having problems with that lately. So I'm just going to talk about it. My pick of the week is a hardware pick, and it's called a Kano Kit, K-A-N-O. And what this is this was a Kickstarter project that was started by a guy, he's probably in Australia. I have no idea, though. What this is the whole concept behind it is that building a computer should be as easy as building something with Legos. So it's an entire kit with a Raspberry Pi computer. It's $130. You've got a Raspberry Pi and all of the accessories that you need with it. It's got some stickers, and you're literally coding within minutes. So you put the thing together, you plug it in, start it up, and hook it up to a monitor using the HDMI cord or a TV or whatever, and then you can be building programs in Linux literally within minutes. It's really easy from what I've seen, and it looks like it'd be a lot of fun. So that's my pick of the week, is the Kano Kit.
Sounds like right up Sally's alley.
Definitely. Cool stuff.
Sally, you have a pick?
I do, but my screen share is failing me, Martin. I don't know if you've tried it lately, but it's not working.
No,
seems like Google gives you one option at screen share now, and when you turn it back off, you can't get it back.
Really?
So
that is a bug.
It happened to us last week, and now it's happening again. Unfortunately, I can still tell you about my pick, though, because it is an iOS app. I did not check to see if they have an Android version, but it's called Nutrition Menu. And I've been making use of it quite often lately because it has accurate nutrition label type information for restaurants in particular. And they have just a whole ton of restaurants in their database. over 49,000 restaurant menu items for 360 USA and some Canadian restaurants. And this is a big deal in my family. I have some children, actually two children, with diabetes now. So we need to know carb counts. And so it's really excellent for that. Have it in my pocket and pull it out wherever we are and be able to have confidence that we're counting our carbs correctly for diabetes management. But it has a lot more to it. It's won a lot of awards. It's got great reviews. The price is $1.99. You can use it with different weight loss programs, so it has a journaling feature. It'll count points for Weight Watchers and lots of different things. So if you're looking for something for tracking calories or carbs or exercise or whatever, Nutrition Menu comes highly recommended from yours truly. That's my pick.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. And my screen share app is AWOL as well. So it's it seems to be equal opportunity.
Yeah.
I have to do a little research on that. Maybe it's browser related. I don't know.
We're using
just glad
Chrome.
It's not my fault.
What's that?
He said, I'm just glad it's not my fault.
Maybe you guys that are Google certified or in training can rattle some cages and figure out why that's not working for us.
Yeah.
About that. My pick of the week is actually a hardware device, and one of the things that I get to do, which is kind of a cool thing, is to pick up a device once in a while and test out the Wells mobile app. And one of the devices I picked up the other day was on special was the Kindle Fire HDX. It was on sale for, I think, $179, something like that. And actually, I was very pleasantly surprised with the device. It's, you know, those of you that are watching can see it. It's a fairly, it's about the same size as a Nexus 7. It's not quite as wide. You're holding it horizontally or in landscape. It's a little bit taller. It's a little bit different form factor. You can still easily hold it in your hand. I would say it's a sweet spot. So first of all, it's got great battery life, which is wonderful. I can get about 11, 12 hours on this. I would say its sweet spot is for those people who maybe are new to the tablet market. I'm thinking grandparents, you know, some, you know, those that aren't real comfortable with technology, because right up front, and it really obviously puts things right in front of you that you're maybe going to want, because it really focuses on books, for instance, so that your books are in this little carousel at the top, and recently used apps as well. You have Facebook and Twitter and email and a lot of the same Android apps. I would say it's not as full as the Google Play Store. They've kind of restricted that. That'll only work on this device. Most of the things that you're probably going to want if you're just more of an average tablet user are going to be on here. You can install apps just like you can on any Nexus device. So that's really not an issue. And a couple of the cool hardware things, you've got great audio on this. There's speakers on the back here. You probably can't see this on the screen, but you have full-fledged vented speakers here, which are a lot better than that hole that you'll sometimes get with some of these tablet devices. I would say it's better than the iPad, and definitely better than the Nexus 7, but those aren't any slouches either. So you've got that real easy buttons on off on the back, and then volume on the back. It charges with a micro
USB.
Micro USB, right? And so it charges pretty quickly. It has Bluetooth. And it has a front-facing camera. No rear-facing camera, so you're really not going to take photos with it. So that's one difference between this and, say, the Nexus 7 or an iPad. It's meant more for personal, you know, use rather than, you know, doing that, although it does have a Photos app and, you know, all the stuff that comes with a typical Android device. So I'd say I'm very impressed with with a number of things about the tablet. So if you're in the market, or especially maybe for a gift, a lot of our viewers are more geeky and they're going to want a little bit more power, so I'd say maybe go with the iPad or Nexus 7 or Nexus 10 tablet. But if you're thinking about getting a tablet for maybe a child or for a grandparent, somebody like that, this is a great choice. It syncs all your Kindle books, so if you're a reader, this is a really good app to have. They have this new feature called Mayday. You've probably seen the commercials for that, where you can press a button and talk to somebody. I haven't actually tried that, but it's very prominent on the device. If you need help, they're trying to make this as easy as possible. Works seamlessly with the Amazon store and the Kindle store. So if you're buying a book, it immediately appears. Movies the same way. So if you've got a Prime account, works really well for that. So nice little device. I'll probably write up a full review on this and do a compare and contrast between this and the Nexus 7, since I have both of those at this point. But I like it. That's the Kindle Fire HDX. You can get it anywhere now. I think there's bins of them at Best Buy, and you can obviously get it on Amazon. I think it's $199 right now. If I could share my screen, I'd show you what it looks like on Amazon. But it comes in different storage sizes, 16, 32, 64 gigs. And hey, there's also a Wi-Fi only or an LTE AT&T or Verizon versions as well.
And did we hear how well the Wells mobile app looks on the Kindle Fire HD?
That's one of the reasons I got the tablet. I have to actually submit it to the Amazon store so it appears in the store. It's not there.
If
you search for Wells Mobile, you won't get it. Now, you can use their browser, which they call the Silk browser, and go to m.wells.net, and it works perfectly fine there, just like it does in any other mobile browser. So that works pretty well. It's the same experience. You just can't find it and install it in the App Store. So we're going to hopefully change that with the next rollout of Wells Mobile.
Stay tuned, Kindle Fire users.
Yeah.
All right. Our time is getting away from us, Martin. I'm wondering how we should manage the rest of the show.
Why don't we jump to our feedback real quickly and just pick a couple there. There's a couple that I actually wanted to show you. So I think we will save those for later. One from my beloved is one that really can't be explained. You really have to show it. Sally, you want to pick something out there that you want to share?
Yeah, I definitely want to share some feedback we got from Theodore Kufall, who watched last week's show when we were talking about going paperless, Martin. And he says, I was very excited to see this topic on the podcast. I've been in the process of trying to make this transition for a few years now. I found that, and I just lost my note. How about that? Don't move your mouse when you're reading. Even on a personal level, the unwillingness of others to move in this direction is the biggest obstacle to achieving a paperless life. And he gives an example, wanting to do more paperless things, asking people to send him things electronically, and people just kind of balking at that concept, and bucking the system, not wanting to go with paperless agendas and things like that. So even if you want to be paperless, maybe the people around you are kind of hindering that effort. And I kind of wrote back and encouraged him that it does take corporate buy-in, and that's definitely a challenge. But I think we can still, chip away at it personally and be leaders in that regard and let other people see, demonstrated for them how you can dial up whatever information you need in a very quick fashion because you have it stored electronically and organized in a logical way. So, yeah, keep up the good work. That's my encouragement.
Very good. Thank you for sharing. Do you have others you want to go through real quick?
I will just make mention that there's some great articles we're going to include in the show notes, links to articles about e-newsletters in particular. Jason Winjet, who helped me with the pronunciation of his name. Thank you, Jason. He's in Winona, Minnesota, and he sent several articles about church email newsletters in particular. One of them's titled, Is Your Pastor a Nigerian Prince? I love that. What the point was is that if you misuse your email and send out things from your personal email address, you'll very quickly get your email labeled as a spammer. and you know, things will get rejected right and left, and you have to go through a lot of hoops to get that cleaned up. So using an email program like MailChimp or Constant Contact is probably a much better way to go if you're looking at doing church email newsletters. So good tips, and there's another article with 7 ways to run an unsuccessful mobile email campaign, so just kind of tongue-in-cheek written, with things that you want to make sure, pitfalls you want to make sure and avoid. So watch for those links in the show notes as well.
Very good. If you would like to contribute to the show, we wish you would, go to wellstech.wells.net, write a comment on one of the show notes pages or essentially blog posts, email wellstech@wells.net, and many other social networking opportunities, including Sally's personal favorite, Pinterest.
That's right.
And all those links are there on the show notes page. Just a reminder, if you are not watching this live, you're watching or listening in a post-dated fashion, we encourage you to consider carving out an hour of your time on Tuesday afternoons, 4 o'clock, if that is in your schedule. We do it live every week, and we're going to try and be religious about it if we can. And we'll let you know if that's not the case. You can always see a schedule of upcoming shows on the show notes page as well, what those topics are, including next week's show. And we're returning to our book review, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, Chapter 8, The Church of Google. Interesting topic. We spent a lot of time talking about Google today, and we'll do a little bit more from the perspective of Nicholas Carr.
Correct.
I almost said Nicholas Sparks. That's a different genre, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think so.
All right, Jason, we really appreciate you being here. Thanks so much for your time. And we look forward to having you back again to talk about educational technology. Thanks
much. Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Yep. It's a lot of fun for me.
Before you leave, everybody, be sure to go to the show notes page for our music download of the week. Chris Dreisbach, Modern Evangelist is the name of the song. There'll be a bit.ly link right there on the show notes page for 1 week. You can download Chris Dreisbach's music at your leisure. Thanks, everybody, for joining us, and we will talk to you next week.